Hello, everyone, and welcome to Petite Queen's Claim Your Career Crown podcast. I'm your host, Lynn, and today we're joined by our VP of Operations, Amanda, and our wonderful guest, Dr. Glenn Livingston. So I have to tell you, we have such a great show in store for you today. We're going to be talking about how to stop overeating and binge eating and instead make healthier food choices. And I want to share a little bit about Dr. Glenn Livingston. He is a veteran psychologist and was a longtime CEO of a multi-million dollar consulting firm, which has serviced several Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. Today, he is the author of the book, Never Binge Again. And after a personal journey out of obesity, Glenn spent decades researching the psychology behind overeating and binge eating. His unique way of approaching food choices has helped countless individuals to develop a normal, healthy weight and a much more lighthearted relationship with food. He is not promoting a specific diet. Rather, he's helping people understand and overcome what leads to overeating and to avoid it. So he's also, that's amazing, Glenn is a daily blogger with Psychology Today, and he has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, ABC, and many, many more. Glenn, welcome. We are so thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, this is going to be so wonderful. And for all of those of you who are joining us for the very first time, don't miss a single episode by subscribing to Claim Your Career Crown wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please share the love and click 5 stars for your review. We would very much appreciate it. Glenn, let's get right into this. What led you to focus your research and career on weight loss and binge eating? And, you know, share with our audience how and why you are qualified to talk about these things.
Well, have you ever been to the Woodbury Country Deli on Syosset, Long Island? Probably not.
I have not.
If you'd been there and they were out of chocolate and pizza, there was a good chance it's because I got there before you. So that's my way of saying that I'm not just a doctor who decided to work with binge eaters. I'm someone who had a serious problem myself. As a matter of fact, I didn't work with overeaters for the most part when I was younger because I had the problem. I was a child and family therapist, and I came from a family of 17 psychotherapists. And if anybody asked, if something broke in the house, we all know how to ask it how it feels, and nobody knew how to fix it. It was that kind of thing. But when I was about 17, you can't tell here, I'm 6'4", I'm a little broad-shouldered just naturally. And I figured out that if I worked out really hard, I could eat whatever I wanted to without getting fat. So 2-3 hours a day, then, you know, a whole pizza, a box of Pop-Tarts, box of muffins, lattes. We didn't call them lattes back then. And I thought it was great. Like Doug Graham says, I thought it was a superpower, not a problem. But when I was about 22, 23 years old, I had gotten married. I was commuting 2 hours each way to go to work, to see patients, to go to school, and to go to school more than work. And, you know, then I'd get home and I'd have to help run the business, and we would have almost no time to talk, and I had zero time to work out. My workouts really suffered. But I found that the food still had a hold of me. It's like it had a life of its own, and I just kept eating and eating and eating. And the worst part of it is I got a little older and I was taking on more serious patients was that I couldn't be 100% present. If you know anything about psychology, it's not really an intellectual endeavor. You think someone's going to come and present you with the puzzle of their life, and you're going to say, just rotate this piece over here and move this over here and put it all together and things are going to be great. And they'll say, okay, doc, I'll get right on that. It's just not how it works. They have to love and trust you enough to be willing to do that in the first place. And so if you're not present, if you're not lending them your soul, then you don't really get the results that you want. And that was always most important to me. Was just, you know, being the best psychologist that I could. So even more so than my weight that was going up and up and my triglycerides were going up and up and all the other physical problems I was having, I was upset that I couldn't be present. I'd be, you know, sitting with a suicidal patient and thinking, when can I get a pizza? And I just wasn't there. And I never lost anybody, but, you know, thank goodness I managed to compensate. And so being from a family of psychotherapists, I went the traditional route. I saw the best psychologists around. I saw the best psychiatrists. I took medication. I went to Overeaters Anonymous. And I didn't commute and I didn't have kids. My ex-wife was traveling for business. So I had an awful lot of time to develop a second career. And so while I'm busy trying to heal the hole in my heart so that I could stop trying to heal the hole in my stomach, I was consulting for big food companies and big pharma also, big food. And I was really on the wrong side of the war. You know, I was watching them spend millions of dollars to engineer these hyper palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and excitotoxins, and they're excitotoxins. They're all targeted at the reptilian brain, and they're trying to hit their bliss point without giving you enough nutrition to feel satisfied. So of course, the result is that you feel addictive. And in the middle of all this deep psychological work, which I don't regret, was a very spiritual journey. It was a very soulful journey. But in the middle of all that deep psychological work, I realized that, wait a minute, this doesn't have anything to do, at least this part. This is a very powerful force outside of me personally. It has nothing to do with the fact that my mama didn't love me enough or that I was in a bad marriage or anything like that, or that there was a hole in my heart. This is just an outside force that's targeted at a part of my brain, the reptilian brain, the very oldest part of my brain, which is responsible for feast and famine, survival drives, fight or flight. And that part of the brain doesn't know love. The reptilian brain, the lizard, it looks at something in the environment and it says, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Or do I kill it? It's eat, mate, or kill. It's like a bad college drinking game. Love comes from the higher layers of the brain. There's the mammalian brain that says, wait a minute, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is that going to have on the members of your tribe that you love? And then there's the neocortex on top of that that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact that will have on the type of person you're trying to be in your tribe? What impact will that have on your pursuit of, you know, spirituality or music or art or work or contribution or your long-term goals like health and fitness and things like that? And so it's this primitive part of the brain that these companies are targeting, and it does nothing to do with love. So here I am spending, I'm covering a wide span of time. It took me about 25 years to figure this all out. I'm spending about 25 years to try to love myself thin, but it might not have anything to do with love. I saw also that the advertising industry was very good at making you believe that you need their stuff to survive. And every time you're looking for love at the bottom of a bag or a box or a container, there's some fat cat in a white suit with a mustache that's laughing all the way to the bank, right? And you know, for example, this is just an example. I was consulting for a major food bar manufacturer, who I will not name so I do not get sued. And the VP of that company was actually a friend of mine and vice president of marketing. And he said to me as he was leaving the company, you know what, Glenn, I'm a little embarrassed, but our most profitable insight was taking the vitamins out of the bar and putting the money into the packaging instead. So they made the packaging look very multicolored and diverse and bright. And in nature, a diversity of bright colors in the food world would signal a diversity of micronutrients that are available. Think about the instruction to eat the rainbow. That's a natural evolutionary response to get the nutrition that we need. When we look at a salad and we're eating dark lettuce and yellow carrots and red tomatoes and blueberries and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we're more likely to get the nutrients that we need. And so we have this evolutionary response that says that's where the good stuff is. But yet they had taken the good stuff out of the bars because they were too expensive and they put the money into faking us out instead. It's not a single example. It is a single example, but I don't mean to single them out because that happens all across the industry. Then there was one more thing that happened that caused me to shift my paradigm. I'd been trying to love myself thin all those years. And then I did this study. I figured I was making all this money doing these big studies for these corporations. I should do one for myself. And the days when internet clicks were cheap and I could intercept people that were searching for stress solutions, I got about 40,000 people over the course of 5 years to come to my website and take a survey. And I asked them what they were stressed about. I asked them what they tended to turn to with food that they couldn't stop eating when they were stressed. And I found three interesting things. One of them was that when people struggled with chocolate, and that was me, I started all my binges with chocolate. Then I would go to pizza and lattes and donuts, but it would all be, you know, come on, just one bite, you'll start tomorrow. You worked out hard enough, it's not going to hurt. And then there'd be more chocolate and more chocolate and the rest of the binge. People who struggle their lives with chocolate, they tended to be lonely, brokenhearted, or depressed. And it was kind of true. I was not happy in the marriage, and I was overwhelmed, and I was heavy, and I was kind of lonely, brokenhearted, and depressed. People who struggled with soft, chewy things like bagels and bread and pasta, they tended to be stressed at home. And if they were struggling with salty, crunchy things like chips and pretzels, they tended to be stressed at work. I thought that was really interesting, but before I did anything with it, because remember, I was not working with overeaters, I decided I'd call my mom, and I'd ask my mom. And she was a psychotherapist, and she raised me, and she also struggled with chocolate, so I thought this would be a good conversation. And I remember this was over Skype. It was probably about 12 years ago, and I asked her what this could come from. I said, people were struggling with what we do. We tend to go to chocolate, but was there some pattern in my history that taught me to go to chocolate? And she gets this horrible look on her face. She says, I'm so sorry, honey. I'm so sorry. I said, Mom, what is it? It's okay. It's 40 years ago. Because this is, you know, a while ago. It's 40 years ago. I don't care. I love you. I just want to figure this out. And she says, I'm so sorry. But when you were 1 year old in 1965, your grandfather, my father, had just gone to jail. And he was guilty. And my whole life, I had idolized him. He's the only person I could count on in my life. And he was guilty. And he disappeared. And I was really depressed. At the same time, your father, you know, my husband, had been in the army. He was in the army. He was a captain in the army. And they were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And I was terrified. So half the time when you came running to me for love or a hug or to play or even for some healthy food, I didn't have the wherewithal to take care of you. I'd just be sitting and staring at the wall, feeling anxious and depressed myself. So what I did is I kept a little refrigerator on the floor. And I kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in the refrigerator. And I'd say, honey, go get your Bosco. And you'd go crawling over to the Bosco, you'd open the refrigerator, you'd open the bottle, you'd suck on the cap, and you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. And it seemed like, you know, gosh, if this was a movie, this was a perfect movie moment, we'd have a big hug and a big cry, and I would never have trouble with chocolate again, right? I would forgive my mom. So we kind of had a metaphorical hug. We were over Skype. And I got to know my mom a lot better as a result of the conversation. I could forgive her. There were all kinds of things we talked about her life. I could forgive myself. So it was a good conversation to have. But my chocolate eating got worse. Yeah. And the reason my chocolate eating got worse was because I discovered there was this voice of justification in my head. And it went something like this. You know what, Glenn, you're right. Her mama didn't love us enough. And she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in our heart. And until we can, you know, get out of this marriage and find the love of our life and really fix that, we're going to have to go right on binging on chocolate. Let's go get some more right now. Yippee. And that changed my paradigm. But between that and what I saw going on in industry, that changed my paradigm. And I realized that there were certain biological functions that rather than loving ourselves into the right action, we kind of assertively took control over. Like, for example, if I really, really had to pee right now, I would tell my bladder, I hear you. But, you know, I'm talking to Lynn and Amanda, and this is more important right now. I'll be okay. I'll take care of my authentic needs later. But I'm in control, not you. Tough luck. You can't do that. You know, I don't go running after pretty women on the street and kiss them on the lips, right? There's a time and a place, and I'm kind of shy, so I don't really do that anyway. but you know what I mean? It's a very powerful biological urge that I take control over because I'm a civilized member of society. And I said to myself, why can't I be like an alpha wolf And just think of these urges to overeat like any other biological urge that I can take control over. And when an alpha wolf is challenged for leadership, it doesn't go, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. It growls and it snarls and it puts the challenger back in place. So this is what I did. And it's rather embarrassing because I'm a sophisticated psychologist and you read all my credentials at the beginning. What I did was, this is going to be totally private, I decided I was going to draw a very clear line in the sand so I would know what healthy behavior and what healthy was and wasn't. For example, I think one of the first rules was, I will never have chocolate on anything but a Saturday again, right? I'll never have it during the week again. I forget exactly what it was. But I knew that then if there was a voice in my head that said, oh my God, you know, that chocolate bar up at Starbucks friend kind of looks amazing. You worked out really hard. You're not going to gain weight. Besides, chocolate comes from a cocoa bean, which grows on a plant, and therefore chocolate's a vegetable. I knew that that wasn't me. That was my inner pig that was squealing for chocolate. And I would say, wait a minute, it's Wednesday. Chocolate is pig slop on a Wednesday. I don't eat pig slop. I know the farm animals tell me what to do. This was totally private. I wish I called it a food monster. I wish I called it something different, because then I wouldn't have millions of readers telling me I was the pig guy now. But I didn't. I called it my inner pig. And it wasn't a total miracle, but it would wake me up at the moment of impulse and give me those extra microseconds to make the right choice if I wanted to. And slowly but surely, I realized that I was making the rules, that there was no reason to make rules that I wouldn't follow. So I kind of adjusted the rules to something that I would follow. I played with different types of rules. And over time, I found that there was no point to breaking rules that I made myself. And I would just make really simple rules. And then I stopped feeling, the miracle part was that I stopped feeling overwhelmed and powerless. It didn't seem like this mysterious disease inside of me. It seemed like that I was just making the wrong choices, and I started making the right choices. And I wasn't perfect, but you know, I lost about 70 pounds and my physical symptoms resolved. And then for the next 8 years, I would keep a journal about all the crazy things the pig would say. For example, when it would say it's just as easy to start tomorrow, well, the truth is it's not. Because by the principle of neuroplasticity, that's the way the brain works, what fires together, wires together. So if you have the thought, it's just as easy to start tomorrow, and I think I'll get some chocolate today, and then you have the chocolate, what you're doing is reinforcing that connection. You're going to have a deeper hole to dig out of tomorrow. If you're in a hole, you should stop digging. And so I would keep records of all the things the pig would say. I would analyze what was wrong with it. And then I slowly found that what the pig would say didn't have the same power that it used to. Over the course of about 8 years, I really got control of the thing, and it doesn't take that long now. And I was a minor partner in a publishing company when I was getting divorced in 2015. And he asked me if I could write a book, because they wanted to do some experiments. They couldn't get their authors to do it. And I said, okay, I've got this crazy journal, and you're going to think I'm crazy, but you know, I know you have all this respect for me. You won't have this after I send it to you. And so I sent him this journal filled with all my pig squeal and what was wrong with it. And he calls me back 2 weeks later, and he says, Glenn, don't answer pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And he had 100 pounds to lose, and he proceeded to lose almost all the weight over the next 18 months. And the rest is history. So we published it, and I kind of sort of knew what I was doing because I had a dual career in marketing and business. But we had no idea how much it was going to take off. And now we have more reviews than the Da Vinci Code. And people come up to me in a – we do actually. They come up to me in a bookstore. They don't quite know my name, but they point at me and they go, pig guy, which is, you know, really good if you're on a first date. So that's my story.
Yeah, that's quite the journey. And I think a lot of people can relate to many of the things that you went through. Why do so many of us engage in overeating and stress eating and binge eating?
Well, I think there are some very powerful forces in society. Two of them we talked about are the food industry and the advertising industry. There's also the addiction treatment industry that says that you're powerless to do anything about it. You can just abstain one day at a time. And you don't know how powerful these concoctions are. I mean, I once heard Lewis Black say when you can get out of a Starbucks and see another Starbucks across the street, that you know something's happened in society. Well, I once saw a McDonald's right across the street from another McDonald's, and I kind of thought the same thing. Not to single them out either, because there are a lot of companies doing things, but our survival drives are basically hijacked, and then we're given the wrong advice. We're told that we should eat healthy 90% of the time and indulge 10% of the time, right? Which is, in theory, a good piece of advice. If you actually behave like that, you would do well, mostly. But the problem is that it doesn't interact well with the way that willpower actually works, because willpower is the ability to make good decisions. And it turns out that the more decisions you have to make about food over the course of the day, the more likely you are to screw up and make poor decisions later on. So when you say, I'm going to eat chocolate 10% of the time and abstain 90% of the time, well, which is the 10%, which is the 90%? So every time you're in front of that chocolate bar at Starbucks, you have to ask yourself, as opposed to saying, I'm only going to have 1 ounce on Saturday, or yeah, I'm only going to allow myself chocolate for the last 3 days of the calendar month, then you've made all your chocolate decisions. You're still accomplishing the same outcome. But we're told that you should make these decisions all day long. And the truth is, we need to evaluate the places that we have trouble and make our decisions beforehand. So either by making your food decisions in the morning, if it's about an area that you're having trouble with, or by making a rule that just kind of governs how you behave all the time. So that's part of it. I could go on, but there's an incorrect view of emotional eating. People don't understand the interaction between emotions and eating. People think that emotions cause overeating. What they don't know is that overeating also causes emotion. Right. So, for example, people will tell me that they can't go to sleep because they're very anxious unless they eat something bad, or they eat more than they plan to. Yeah. And I'll say, well, okay, anxiety is a physiological state with a cognitive label. Our heart beats a little faster. Sometimes we start sweating. Sometimes I'll get that skin response goes up. Our blood pressure goes up. You can measure all these things externally. If you take animal studies, for example, this study with baboons, where every time they manifested high blood pressure, they gave them a sugar reward. Lo and behold, those baboons are manifesting high blood pressure all the time, much higher. So you're actually creating the anxiety by rewarding it with the food. And a lot of people will tell me, I was really scared that I was going to be overwhelmed with emotion, anxiety, depression, anger, whatever it is. But the truth is, those emotions were much less difficult to manage than I thought they were. It was just the first couple of days while I was withdrawing that was hard. So that's another reason. People don't understand the social pressure to overeat. They think it's all about people just wanting to feel good about what they're eating, but there's a lot more to it. I know we're not going to have our hours to talk about this, but there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons, and I'll go any direction you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd sort of like to dive a little bit into your method, because it involves a food plan. And I'd love to hear, what is a food plan, and how does one make it, and how can we stick to it in the long term? I know that I've done one where I plan my snacks the week ahead so that I'm planning healthier snacks. And I also make the snacks like on Sunday afternoon. And that way I'm having healthier snacks in, because I'm a snacker in the evening. I always want a snack.
There's no work and no decisions to make, right?
Yeah.
That's how you do it. So a food plan is a set of food rules. And I usually recommend that people start with just one food rule. Like we say one simple rule. What's something that you can and would do that doesn't feel too onerous, but would give you a big bang for your buck? And we get things like, I will always put my fork down between bites. I'll never eat in front of a screen again. I won't go back for seconds. I remember a truck driver who lost 150 pounds starting with the idea that he was going to eat fast food all day long, but they're just not going to go back for seconds. And I said, you know, this was not my client. This was someone that I was working with, their client. They said, beautiful, that's exactly what you need to do, because you need to win. Most people have lived this life where they feel like they have their set of best laid plans. They usually set the bar way too high. There's an old nursery rhyme: when she was good, she was very, very good. But when she was bad, she was horrid. And what happens is the pig sets the bar way too high and says, okay, now you're really going to diet so you can make room to binge more. And let's be really, really good. Let's have 800 calories a day. Let's lose 3 pounds a week. And it's not sustainable. People break down and then they feel like they lost. Over time, that breaks their spirit. They remember a time when they kind of could diet and then they can't diet anymore. And it breaks their spirit and they feel like they are their food monster's slave rather than their food monster's boss. So we want to reverse that and start with one simple rule where you can actually win. Something you really can and will do. And then you add rules slowly but surely. When you have the rule, you step back and you listen for that part of your brain that wants to break it and comes up with rationalizations. And believe me, there are going to be parts of your brain that does that. When you hear that part of the brain waking up, you take some steps to take yourself out of the emergency mode. Because remember, the reason we have sayings like just hand over the chocolate and nobody gets hurt is because the need to overeat is really perceived as an emergency. So you need to take yourself out of an emergency mode. A simple way you can do that is to breathe in for a count of 7 and breathe out for a count of 11. If you breathe in for 7, I'm not doing it right now, and then out for 11, you're telling your brain that there's no emergency, because if there was a hungry bear chasing you, you wouldn't have time to breathe out for longer than you were breathing in. So you take a couple of those breaths, and then you carry something to write with and you say, okay, you know, Mr. Food Monster, why should I break my rule and binge now? We consider breaking the rule to be a gateway to a binge. Why should I break the rule and binge? And you see exactly what it says and you write it down. The act of writing is an upper brain function, right? Whereas the act of binging is just kind of an automatic lower brain function. So you write it down. Just the act of writing it down, you worked out hard enough. You can start tomorrow anyway. It's going to be just as easy. Therefore, you should break the rules and eat this chocolate right now. Yippee, 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 let's do it. So you write that all out. And then you look at what you wrote, and you don't try to do this in your head. You look at what you wrote and you say, how is my food monster lying to me? What's wrong with what it's saying? And it usually wins by telling a half truth with a bigger lie. There's going to be some part of what it's saying that's true, like, you know, in some ways it would feel easier to start tomorrow because then I don't have to abstain today. But then you say, well, what's the lie? But the lie is, and it's what I told you before, that what fires together wires together. I'm in a hole. I have to stop digging. I always use the present moment to be healthy. That's the only moment I can ever eat. If I always eat healthy now, the future is an infinite string of now, so I will always eat healthy. And you write this all down. You kind of keep records of it, and over time you'll see a pattern. This is like a muscle. You get better at it. And and the last thing you do is you say, do I have any authentic needs? Yeah. I got myself off of chocolate by having kale banana smoothies. I actually usually was having the craving. Sometimes it was just psychologically generated, but usually I was having the craving because I was genuinely hungry and needed some energy. And so my lizard brain was confused. You know, those fat cats in white suits with mustaches were happy that their chocolate bar was sitting on the counter. And I would have to take myself away from that, take care of my own physiological need. And that's what I did. That's what I did. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the basics.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. I think it makes sense, like, you know, to take the baby steps. And I think by setting the bar low enough that you can achieve it, it actually does motivate you to keep going, keep pushing.
Yeah. And then you can add more. Usually people don't lose weight right away. Mm-hmm. But they feel better right away. They stop obsessing about food as much, and they realize they have control. And then you carefully assess what rules you need to change in order to take the weight off. And not everybody needs to lose weight. And I find that people do better if they lose weight slowly.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. How can we recover if we do deviate from that food plan or go on a binge? How do you re-motivate yourself?
So one of the things you have to remember is that voice of self-castigation that you hear after you make a mistake. Oh my God, you're pathetic. You're never going to get this. You might as well just give up and be a happy fat person. That voice is actually the lizard brain, and it's binge motivated in and of itself. It wants you to feel weak so that you don't have the strength to, you know, resist the next binge. It doesn't want you to recover. And so it wants you to collect evidence of failure. It wants you to ask, what's wrong with me? Why can't I do this? Why do I keep changing my mind? Well, if you ask that question, your brain is going to seek evidence that there's something wrong with you and you can't do this. And you're going to collect evidence of failure and develop a failure identity. If you collect evidence of success instead, I had 5 cupcakes instead of 15. How come? How did I work that out? I had a 5,000 calorie binge instead of a 20,000 calorie binge. And people do have 20,000 calorie binges. How come? I ate the whole pizza, but not the box. How did I stop myself from doing that? I'm only half joking. For people who really have gone overboard, they know what that's like. So you want to collect evidence of success. You want to recognize that the energy of perfectionism is actually useful. So we're told in our culture to go for progress and not perfection. The problem with doing that when there's some kind of toxic pleasure involved, like, you know, food or drinking, is that what it really means is I'm going to try for a little while until I don't feel like it anymore. And it's antithetical to the energy of winning. The energy of winning is a commitment with perfection. That doesn't mean that you don't forgive yourself if you make a mistake. Just hear me out for a second. When an archer aims at the bullseye, an Olympic archer will not let go of the arrow until they feel themselves at one with the bullseye. They see the arrow going into the bullseye. They're not thinking, maybe I'll hit it, maybe I won't, I'll do the best I can. They're seeing the arrow going into the bullseye. And that's an important mental quality of an Olympic archer, because in the absence of committing with perfection like that, they can't drain their mind of doubt and uncertainty, and doubt and uncertainty drain energy from focusing on the goal. So in order to focus all your energy on the goal, you have to commit with perfection. However, if you miss the bullseye, the Olympic archer doesn't say, oh my goodness, I missed. I'm a pathetic archer. I might as well shoot the rest of the arrows up in the air into the audience, right? They say, no, I missed. By how much? In what direction? I was aiming at a very clearly delineated bullseye. Let me use that feedback to adjust my aim and do better again. So they commit with perfection, but they take it seriously when they miss. They use the information, they forgive themselves with dignity, and they get up and they focus all their energy on the arrow again. If you touch a hot stove, you don't say, oh my God, I'm a pathetic hot stove toucher. Let me just put my whole hand down and let's get it over with, right? You say, how did I miss the stove? I'm glad you think that's funny. How did I miss the stove? How am I going? How come I didn't see the stove? How am I going to avoid it going forward? And so that's really the energy we need. It's okay to experience a little bit of guilt or shame. You know, when the Olympic archer misses, they don't go, yippee, 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 I missed. They say, okay, I want to do better. How do I do better next time? Same thing with the hot stove. You want to go, yippee, I touched a hot stove. You say, no, you want to feel that pain. And there are disorders in this world, by the way, where kids are born without the ability to feel pain. And they don't stay alive very long because they don't have the feedback. So the psychological pain is a little bit of guilt or shame, but you need to be able to let that go, because otherwise your food monster will make you feel too weak to resist the next binge. So that's it's a piercing insight to recognize that all of that self-castigation, all of that yelling at yourself after a mistake is actually driven by the desire to keep binging. And you will find it's very difficult to continue binging if you refuse to keep yelling at yourself.
Yeah.
A mistake is a mistake. Collect evidence of success, analyze what went wrong, make adjustments, and get up and aim with perfection again. That's how you recover.
I think that is absolutely the best, most perfect piece of advice to end today's show with. And Glenn, I mean, thank you so much. You have given us so much information, and I know that you've helped me as I've listened, and many other people who can, make that strive to attain their goal weight by making better food choices and eliminate binge eating. So I know that our audience is going to want to know more about where they can find out more about you, Glenn.
Of course. The easiest thing to do is go to neverbingeagain.com, click the big red button, and sign up for the reader bonuses. You'll get a copy of Never Binge Again in PDF, you get it in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. All the electronic versions are free. The Audible version and the paperback version, there's a charge associated with that, but you can do that if you're a you know, a paperback kind of person, you will get a set of food plan starter templates. So you'll see sample rules that people use. The philosophy is diet agnostic. You can use this with any dietary philosophy you want, as long as you are nutrifying yourself. You can't use this to starve yourself. Just like I tell people, there's some rules you can't make. I could never say I will never pee again because my body is going to tell me otherwise. That's the second time I've talked about urination in the call. So you'll get a free set of food plan starter templates so you can adjust the rules to your need, whether you're, you know, keto or macro or high carb or low carb or point counters or calorie counters, whatever you're doing, there's some sample plans for you. And probably most importantly, I know this sounds really weird. Like in theory, you're saying, the reader saying to themselves, the listener saying to themselves, why do Lynn and Amanda have this doctor on who has a pig inside of them? This is insulting. This is offending. This is really harsh. But if you hear me actually coach people, you'll see that this can take you from feeling despairing and powerless and hopeless about food to feeling hopeful and enthusiastic and bright-eyed about your abilities in just, you know, one session. So we recorded a whole bunch of sessions you can listen to see for yourself. So at neverbingeagain.com, click the big red button and sign up for the reader bonuses.
Well, that is great advice, and I hope everyone takes you up on that. And thank you so much. This has been such an informative discussion. And for everyone who tuned in today, if you have ideas you'd like to share or comments, you can leave them down below. We do love hearing your thoughts on every one of our episodes. And if you have a question or would like to suggest a topic for discussion, you can email us at jointheconversation@petitequeen.com. And to stay current on all of our tremendous resources, articles, these incredible episodes like today, you can sign up for our weekly Wisdoms newsletter at petitetoqueen.com, and you won't miss a single one. Thank you for everyone who tuned in. Amanda, thank you so much. And Dr. Glenn, thank you. Thank you. This has been such a great episode.
Great. Thank you for having me. It was an honor.